Well, it seems like everyone here takes drinking to a whole other level. But let's not forget his accident not too long ago. He did suffer major head trauma.
You know, he seems so fit, I keep forgetting he even had that accident.
Rachel got up from her armchair and sat down next to Nick on the floor. She stared out the window at the twisting skeletal form of Shanghai Tower, a new skyscraper being built across the river that would one day be the tallest structure in the world.
It's so strange. I had this idea that we'd be spending all our time getting to know my dad, meeting other relatives over meals, that sort of thing. But it feels like all we've been doing day after day is partying with Shanghai's Gossip Girl crowd.
Nick nodded in agreement, but he didn't want to sound discouraging. At some point, your dad has to show up. And you know, it's entirely possible we are being paranoid and things haven't worked out because they haven't. Your father is a very important man, and there's a lot cooking on the political front with the changeover in leadership that just happened. Maybe there's some of the drama playing out that has nothing to do with you. Rachel gave him a dubious look.
Do you think I should try to bring it up casually with Carlton?
If there really is something going on with the family, that might put him in an awkward position. Technically speaking, we have been very well looked after by the Bows, haven't we? I mean, we've been enjoying this fabulous suite, and Carlton's been entertaining us every day. Let's see how it plays out. In the meantime, I think it might finally be time for me to try that juice cleanse.
Before you do, we have dinner tonight with Colette's parents.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that.
Do you know where?
I wonder if it's going to be yet another Bacchanalian 20-course feast. Carlton said something about going to a resort. Maybe they'll have cheeseburgers. I would kill for a burger and fries tonight.
Me too. But I don't think that's in the cards. Something tells me Colette's not a burger and fries kind of gal.
What gave that away? I bet you anything her monthly clothing budget exceeds our combined annual incomes.
Monthly? Her weekly clothing budget is probably more accurate. Did you see those carved dragon heel shoes she was wearing last night?
I swear to God, I think they were made of ivory. She's basically Araminta 2.0. Nick chortled. Colette is not Araminta 2.0. Araminta is essentially a Singapore girl. She can glam it up when she wants to, but she's equally comfortable hanging out in yoga sweats and eating fresh coconut on the beach. Colette's a whole other advanced species yet to be classified. I think she'll either be running China or Hollywood in a few years.
And yet she's grown on me. She's been the nicest surprise so far, hasn't she? When I first met her, I was like, this girl cannot be for real. But she's so sweet and so generous. She hasn't let us pick up a single tap since we got here.
I hate to burst your bubble, but I think we've been comped at every restaurant or club we've been to. Do you notice how Colette gets Roxanne to take pictures of her everywhere we go? She just tweets or blogs about every place, and the rest of us eat for free. It's quite a racket.
Still, I think she's good for Carlton.
Yeah, but don't you think she's toying with him? She's clearly into him, and yet she's still chanting this, "He's just one of my many suitors," BS.
Rachel gave Nick a teasing look. You just don't like it when the tables are turned.
Colette's got her own career and her own goals, and she's in no rush to get married.
I think it's so refreshing. Most Chinese girls are under such enormous pressure to get married and have kids by their early 20s. I mean, how many Chinese girls do we get every semester that are really just at NYU to find the perfect husband?
Nick cocked his head and thought about it for a moment.
I can't think of any besides you.
Oh, ha ha, jerk, Rachel said, smacking him with a tasseled pillow.
At 5 that afternoon, as Nick and Rachel stood outside their hotel waiting for Carlton to pick them up, a thunderous roar could be heard coming from the Bund. Nick was dressed casually in jeans, a light blue Oxford shirt, and his fawn-colored Huntsman summer blazer, while Rachel opted for an Erica Tanoff summer linen smock dress. Moments later, a burned apricot McLaren F1 pulled into the driveway of the Peninsula, its engines making a low, deliriously expensive rumble that sent the valet attendants scurrying around excitedly, each hoping for the chance to park this exotic driving machine. Their hopes were dashed when Carlton poked his head out the window and beckoned Nick and Rachel to get in.
"You take the front seat," Nick gallantly offered his wife.
"Don't be ridiculous. My legs are much shorter than yours," Rachel said. Their argument ended up being completely moot, because as the wing doors rose, they saw that the driver's seat was in the center of the car, with a passenger seat flanking either side.
"How cool! I've never seen anything like this," Rachel said.
Nick peered in.
"This is one sexy car you have here. Is it street legal?"
"Hell if I know," Carlton said with a smirk.
"And here I thought you people went around in nothing but Audis," Rachel said as she climbed in on the right side.
"Oh, the Audis belong to Colette's family. You know why everyone drives Audis, don't you? It's the car most high-level politicians drive, so many people drive them because they think that other cars will give way and the police are more likely to leave them alone."
"How interesting," Rachel said, as she settled into a surprisingly comfortable bucket seat. "I love this new car smell."
"Actually, this car isn't new at all. It's from 1998,
Carlton said.
"Really?"
Rachel said in surprise.
"It's considered a classic. I only drive it on sunny, cloudless days like today. You're smelling the hand-stitched Connolly leather hides, made from cows even more pampered than the ones in Kobe."
"Looks like we discovered another one of Carlton's passions," Nick commented.
"Oh, yeah. I've been importing cars for several years now and selling them to friends. I started during my Cambridge days, whenever I came up to London on weekends," Carlton explained as he sped onto Yan'an Elevated Road.
"You must have witnessed the Arab sports car parade around Knightsbridge every year," Nick said.
"You bet. My friends and I would grab a table outside the La Durée and watch them roll by."
"What are you guys talking about?" Rachel asked.
Nick proceeded to explain.
"Every June, all these young Arab squillionaires descend on London, bringing with them the most stupendous sports cars in the world, and they race them around Knightsbridge as if the streets are their private Formula One track. On Saturday afternoons, the cars converge behind Harrods at the corner of Basil Street like some swap meet. All these kids, some not more than 18, dressed in expensive tattered denim, and their girlfriends covered up in their hijabs but wearing blinged-out sunglasses, sitting in these million-dollar automobiles. It's an incredible sight."
Carlton nodded, his eyes flashing with excitement.
"The same thing is happening here. This is now the number one market for luxury cars in the world, especially exotic sports cars. The demand is unquenchable, and all my friends know I'm the best at finding the rarest of the rare. This McLaren we're sitting in, only 64 were ever built. So before a car even arrives on the dock in Shanghai, I have a waiting list of buyers."
"Sounds like a fun way to make a living," Nick commented.
"Tell that to my parents when you see them. They think I'm wasting my life."
"I'm sure they're just concerned for your safety," Rachel said, holding her breath as Carlton suddenly cut across three lanes at 90 miles per hour.
"Sorry, I just need to get around those trucks. Don't worry, I'm a very safe driver."
Nick and Rachel exchanged dubious looks, knowing Carlton's recent history. Rachel checked that her seatbelt was securely fastened and tried not to look at the zigzagging cars in front of them.
"Everyone on the highway seems totally schizo. They're changing lanes constantly," Nick quipped.
"Listen, if you try to drive in an orderly fashion here and stay in your lane all the time, you'll just get killed," Carlton said, accelerating again to overtake a truck full of pigs. "The rational rules of driving do not apply in this country. I learned to drive in the UK, and when I came back to Shanghai, the first time after getting my license, I got pulled over on my first day driving. The police officer screamed at me, 'You bloody fool! Why did you stop at that red light?'"
"Oh yeah, Rachel and I have almost gotten killed trying to cross the road several times. Traffic signals mean nothing to Shanghai drivers," Nick said.
"They are merely suggestions," Carlton agreed, suddenly slamming on the brakes and veering sharply to the right,
narrowly avoiding a van in the far left lane.
Sweet Jesus, was that van actually backing up in the fast lane? Rachel screamed.
Welcome to China, Carlton said nonchalantly. 20 minutes outside of downtown Shanghai, they finally exited the highway, much to Rachel's relief, and turned onto what appeared to be a recently paved boulevard.
Where are we? Rachel asked.
This is a new development called Portofino Elite, Carlton explained. It's modeled after those fancy neighborhoods in Newport Beach.
Clearly, Nick commented as they passed a Mediterranean-style strip mall painted in shades of ochre, complete with a Starbucks.
They turned off the main street and drove down a long avenue flanked by high stucco walls, at the end of which stood a cascading sculptural waterfall next to a gatehouse. Carlton pulled up in front of a massive gate with decorative steelwork panels, and three uniformed guards emerged from the gatehouse. One of the guards walked around the car warily, as if he was looking for hidden explosives, while another used an inspection mirror to peer under the car. The guard in charge recognized Carlton and checked him off a list. He gave Nick and Rachel a careful once-over before nodding and waving the car through.
That's pretty serious security, Nick commented.
Yep, it's very private here, Carlton said.
The heavy gates clanged open, and the McLaren sped down a pristine white gravel road lined with Italian cypresses. Between the trees, Rachel and Nick could make out several small artificial lakes, from the middle of which sprouted fountains, sleek glass and steel buildings here and there, and the undulating mounds of a golf course. Finally, as they passed a pair of weathered obelisks, they came upon the main reception building, a majestic yet minimalist stone and glass structure surrounded by artfully planted pagoda trees.
I had no idea they were building resorts like this in the suburbs outside Shanghai. What's this place called?
Nick asked Carlton.
This isn't actually a resort. This is Colette's weekend retreat.
Excuse me? This whole property is hers? Rachel sputtered.
Yes. All 30 acres of it. Her parents built it for her.
And where do they live?
They have houses in many cities. Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing. But they spend most of their time in Hawaii these days, Carlton explained.
They must have done rather well, Rachel commented.
Carlton gave her a look of amusement.
I guess I never mentioned.
Colette's father is one of the 5 richest men in China. Chapter 8 Colette, Shanghai, China. Carlton's car pulled up to the front entrance of the house, and 2 attendants in matching James Purse black t-shirts and trousers appeared from out of nowhere. One of them helped Rachel out of the car, while the other informed Carlton.
Sorry. You can't leave your car here like you normally do. We are expecting Mr. Bing's arrival. You can either move it around into the car porch, or I can park it for you.
I'll move it. Thanks, Carlton replied.
He zoomed off and returned shortly to join Rachel and Nick at the entrance. The imposing oxidized maple wood doors opened, and they found themselves in a serene inner courtyard, almost entirely composed of a dark, shallow, reflecting pool. A travertine walkway ran down the middle of the pool toward tall lacquered doors the color of espresso, and bamboo block paintings ran along the walls of the courtyard. The lacquered doors parted silently as the 3 of them approached, revealing the inner sanctum. Before them was an immense 80-foot-long living room decorated entirely in tones of black and white. Maids in long black silk qipaos, a body-hugging one-piece Chinese dress for women, created in the 1920s in Shanghai, and perennially be fashionable since Suzy Wong famously seduced Robert Lomax in one. In Singapore and Hong Kong, it is known by its Cantonese name, the Cheongsam. Stood in a silent line by gray shikumen brick pillars hung with black ink calligraphy scrolls, while polished black tile floors and low-slung white sofas suffused the space with a tranquil, seductive vibe. The glass wall at the end of the room revealed an outdoor lounge filled with sleek sofas and dark wood coffee tables, beyond which one could see more reflecting pools and pavilions. Even Nick, who had grown up among the splendors of Tyersal Park, was momentarily taken aback.
"Wow, is this a house or a Four Seasons resort?"
Carlton laughed.
"Actually, Colette fell in love with the Puli Hotel in Shanghai and tried to get her father to buy it. When they found it wasn't for sale, no matter the price, he commissioned his architect to build her this place. This grand salon is inspired by the Puli's lobby."
An Englishman in a dapper black suit approached them.
"Good afternoon. I'm Wolseley, the butler. May I offer you something to drink?"
Before anyone could respond, Colette made her entrance through another door in an oleander pink tea-length dress.
"Rachel! Nick! So glad you could make it!"
With her hair swept up into a high bun and her ruffled gazaar skirt billowing about her as she walked into the room, Colette looked like she had just stepped off the cover of a 1960s issue of Vogue. Rachel greeted her with a hug.
"Colette! You look like you should be having breakfast at Tiffany's or something. And my God, your house is just incredible."
Colette gave a modest giggle.
"Here, let me give you a proper tour. But first, drinks. What libation can we tempt you with? I'm sure Carlton will have his usual tumbler of vodka, and I think I'll have a Campari and soda to match my dress. Rachel, do you feel like a Bellini?"
Sure. Only if it's not too much trouble," Rachel said.
"Not at all. We always have fresh white peaches for our Bellinis, don't we, Wolseley? Nick, what will it be?"
"I'll have a gin and tonic."
"Ugh, the boys are so boring."
Colette rolled her eyes at Wolseley.
"Come, follow me. Did Carlton explain to you my whole concept for this house?"
"We heard that you like some hotel in Shanghai," Rachel began.
"Yes, the Puli. But I've made this house even more luxurious. We used precious materials that you just wouldn't want to use in a public space like a hotel. I know many people have this impression that everyone in China lives in tacky Louis XIV mansions where everything is dipped in gold and it looks like a tassel factory exploded. So I wanted this house to be a showplace for the best of contemporary China. Every piece of furniture you see in this grand salon was custom designed and handcrafted here by our finest designers in the rarest materials. And of course, all the antiques are museum quality. The scrolls on the walls are by Wu Bo Li from the 14th century. And that Ming Dynasty wine cup over there? I bought it from a dealer in Xi'an 2 years ago for $600,000. The curator from the St. Louis Museum just offered me $15 million for it. As if I would ever sell."
Rachel stared at the small porcelain bowl painted with chickens, trying to believe it was worth 100 times her annual salary. The group stepped out into the back courtyard, which was dominated by another vast reflecting pool. Colette led them along a covered walkway as a haunting new-agey song played softly on hidden outdoor speakers.
"The pride of this estate is my greenhouse. The most important thing you should know is that this whole property is 100% certified green. All the roofs have solar paneling, and all the reflecting pools actually flow into a state-of-the-art aquaponics system."
The four of them entered a futuristic glass roof structure that was blindingly lit and lined with alternating rows of fish tanks and vegetable patches.
"All the water gets channeled into the tanks, where we farm fish for eating. And then the nutrient-rich water fertilizes the organic vegetables grown here. See? I'm not just green. I'm emerald green,"
Colette proudly informed them.
"Okay, I'm officially impressed," Nick said.
Crossing the central courtyard again, Colette continued to explain.
"Even though the buildings are modern in style, there are 8 interconnected pavilions arranged in an Empress throne formation to ensure proper feng shui. Everybody stop!"
They stopped, dead in their tracks.
"Now breathe in the air." Can't you just feel the good chi flowing everywhere?
Nick could only detect a faint scent that reminded him of Febreze, but he nodded along with Rachel and Carlton.
Colette put her hands in the namaskara position and beamed. Here we come to the entertainment pavilion. The wine cellar takes up the entire lower level. It was specially designed for us by the Tattinger people. And this is the screening room.
Rachel and Nick poked their heads into a cinema where there were 50 ergonomic Swedish recliners arranged in stadium-style seating.
Do you see what's hiding at the back? Carlton asked.
Rachel and Nick stepped into the room and discovered that the entire back area of the screening room under the projector booth contained a slick sushi bar that looked like it had been transplanted straight from Tokyo's Roppongi district. A sushi chef in a black kimono bowed at them while his young apprentice sat at the bar carving radishes into cute little kitten faces.
Get out of town, Rachel exclaimed.
And we thought we were being extravagant ordering in from Blue Ribbon Sushi on Survivor Wednesdays, Nick quipped.
Did you see the documentary about the greatest sushi master in the world? Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
Colette asked.
Oh my God, don't tell me that guy is one of his sons.
Rachel gaped in awe at the sushi chef as he stood behind the blonde wood counter massaging an octopus.
No, that's Jiro's second cousin,
Colette said excitedly. From there, the tour continued to the guest wing, where Colette showed off bedroom suites more sumptuous than any five-star hotel.
We only allow our guests to sleep on Harston's mattresses stuffed with the finest Swedish horsehair.
Mattress makers to the Swedish royal family since 1852. The basic Harston's mattress starts at $15,000, and their top-of-the-line 2000T will set you back $120,000. But how much is it worth to you to sleep on a mattress that aficionados claim can actually prevent cancer?
And then into her bedroom pavilion, which had wraparound glass walls and a sunken circular lotus pond at one end of the room. The only other objects in the lusciously minimalist space were a cloud-like king-size bed in the middle of the room and beeswax pillar candles flanking one wall.
I like my bedroom to be very zen. When I sleep, I detach from all my worldly possessions.
Adjoining the bedroom pavilion was a structure four times its size, Colette's bathroom and closet. Rachel stepped into the bathroom, which was a sprawling daylight-flooded space entirely clad in glacier-white Calcutta marble. Indentations were carved into the giant slab of unpolished marble to create organic-shaped sinks that looked like watering holes for chic hobbits. And beyond was a private circular courtyard with a dark blue malachite reflecting pool. Growing out of the center of the pool was a perfectly manicured willow tree, and nestled under it was an egg-shaped bathtub that appeared to have been sculpted from a single piece of white onyx. Round stepping stones led across the water to the tub.
Oh my God, Colette, I'm just going to come right out and say it. I am insanely jealous. This bathroom is just beyond. It's straight out of my dreams, Rachel exclaimed.
Thank you for appreciating my vision,
Colette said, her eyes getting a little moist. Nick looked at Carlton.
Why are women so obsessed with their bathrooms? Rachel was obsessed with the bathroom in our hotel, the bathroom at the Annabelle Lee boutique, and now it looks like she's found bathroom nirvana.
Colette stared at Nick with contempt.
Rachel, this man doesn't understand women at all. You should get rid of him.
Trust me, I'm beginning to think about it, Rachel said, sticking her tongue out at Nick.
All right. When we get back to New York, I'll call the contractor and you can retile the bathroom like you wanted.
Nick sighed.
I don't want it retiled, Nick. I want this. Rachel declared, stretching her arms out and caressing the lip of the onyx tub as if it was a baby's bottom.
Colette grinned.
Okay, we better skip the tour of my closets. I don't actually want to be blamed for your breakup.
Why don't I show you the spa?
The party walked through a deep crimson passageway and were shown dimly lit treatment rooms decorated with Balinese furniture. And then they came to a stunning underground space with pillars like a Turkish seraglio, surrounding a massive indoor saltwater pool that glowed in a resting shade of cerulean blue.
"The entire floor of the pool is inlaid with turquoise," Colette announced.
"You've got your own private spa right here," Rachel said in disbelief.
"Rachel, we're good friends now. I have a confession to make. I used to have a terrible addiction. I was addicted to spa resorts. Before I found myself, I used to spend the whole year aimlessly flying from resort to resort. But I was never satisfied, because something was never quite right everywhere I went. I would find a dirty mop left in the corner of the steam room at the Almanjana in Marrakesh, or I would have to put up with some creepy pot-bellied guy staring at me sunbathing in the infinity pool at one and only Rithi Ra. So I decided I could only be happy if I could create my personal spa resort right here."
"Well, you're very fortunate that you have the resources to make this happen," Rachel said.
"Yes, but I'm also saving so much money by doing this. This whole development used to be farmland, and now that there are no more farms, I employ all the displaced locals to work on the estate. So it's really been good for the economy. And think of all the carbon offset points I'm racking up by not having to fly all over the world every weekend trying out new spas,"
Colette said earnestly. Nick and Rachel nodded their heads diplomatically.
"I also hold many charitable events here. Next week, I'm planning a summer garden party with the actress Pan Ting Ting. It's going to be an ultra-exclusive fashion show with the latest collections from Paris. Rachel, tell me you'll come."
"Of course I will," Rachel politely replied, before wondering why she had agreed so quickly. The words ultra-exclusive fashion show filled her with dread, and she suddenly got flashbacks to Araminta's private island bachelorette party.
Just then, a few thin barks could be heard coming down the stairs.
"My babies are back!" Colette shrieked.
The group turned to see Colette's personal assistant Roxanne entering with two Italian greyhounds straining excitedly against their ostrich leather leashes.
"Kate! Pippa! I've missed you so much, poor little things. Are you jet-lagged?"
Colette cooed as she bent down and cuddled her emaciated dogs.
"Did she really name her dogs?"
Rachel began to whisper in Carlton's ear.
"Yes, she did. Colette adores the royals. At her parents' house in Ningbo, she has a pair of Tibetan mastiffs named Wills and Harry," Carlton explained.
"How were my darlings? Did everything go okay?"
Colette asked Roxanne with a worried expression.
"Roxanne just flew Kate and Pippa on Colette's plane to see a famous dog psychic in California," Carlton informed Rachel and Nick. "They were very good. You know, at first I had my doubts about that pet psychic in Ojai, but wait till you read her report. Pippa is still traumatized by the time she almost got blown out of the Bentley convertible. That's why she tries to burrow under the backseat and poo-poos every time she rides in it. I told the woman nothing. How did she know you had that kind of car? I am a total believer in pet psychics now," Roxanne reported earnestly.
Colette petted her dog with tears in her eyes.
"I am so sorry, Pippa. I'll make it up to you. Roxanne, please take a picture of us and post on WeChat. Reunited with my girls."
Colette posed expertly for the picture and stood up, smoothing away the wrinkles on her skirt. She then said to Roxanne in a blood-chilling tone,
"I never want to see that Bentley again."
The group approached the final pavilion, the largest building of all, and the only one that did not have any exterior windows.
"Roxanne, code,"
Colette ordered, and her headset-wearing assistant dutifully punched in an 8-digit code that unlocked the door.
"Welcome to my family's private museum," Colette said.
They stepped into a gallery the size of a basketball arena,
and the first thing that caught Rachel's eye was a large silkscreen canvas of Chairman Mao.
"Is that a Warhol?" she asked.
"Yes. Do you like my Mao? My father gave that to me for my 16th birthday."
"What a cool birthday present," Rachel remarked.
"Yes. It was the favorite out of all my presents that year. I wish I had a time machine so I could go back and Andy could do my portrait."
Colette sighed. Nick stood in front of the painting, staring with amusement at the communist leader's receding hairline, alternately wondering what the dictator or the artist might have made of a girl like Colette Bing. Nick and Rachel began heading toward the right, but Colette said,
"Oh, you can skip that gallery over there. That's just filled with boring junk my father had to have when he first started collecting. Picassos, Gauguins, that sort of thing. Come see what I've been buying lately."
They were steered into a gallery where the walls were a veritable checklist of the artists du jour from all the international art fairs. A mouth-watering Vic Mooney's chocolate syrup painting. Bridget Riley's migraine-inducing canvas of overlapping tiny squares. A heroin field scrawl by Jean-Michel Basquiat, and of course, an immense Mona Kuhn image of two preposterously photogenic Nordic youths posing nude on a dewy doorstep. Rounding the corner, they came into an even larger gallery that contained only one enormous piece of art, 24 scrolls that were hung together to form a vast, intricate landscape. Nick was taken aback.
"Hey, isn't that the Palace of 18 Perfections? I thought Kitty..."
At that moment, Roxanne gasped in alarm and put her hand over her earpiece.
"Are you sure?" she said into her headset before grabbing Colette's arm. "Your parents just checked in at the guardhouse."
Colette looked panic-stricken for a split second.
"Already? They're much too early. Nothing's ready."
Turning to Rachel and Nick, she said,
"I'm sorry to end the tour now, but my parents have arrived."
The group rushed back toward the Grand Salon as Colette barked out orders to Roxanne.
"Alert all staff. Where's that damn Wolseley? Tell Ping Gao to start cooking the parchment chicken now, and tell Baptiste to decant the whiskey. And why aren't the bamboo groves around the central pool lit?"
"They're on a timer. They don't come on until 7 o'clock along with the lights," Roxanne responded.
"Turn everything on now, and turn off the silly whimpering man. You know my father only likes listening to Chinese folk songs. And get Kate and Pippa into their cages. You know how allergic my mother is."
Hearing their names, the dog started yapping excitedly.
"Kill the Bon Iver, and put on the Peng Li Yuan."
Not only is she China's most renowned contemporary folk singer, she's also the first lady, being married to President Xi Jinping.
Roxanne rasped into her headset as she ran toward the service wing with the dogs, almost tripping on their leashes. By the time Carlton, Colette, Nick, and Rachel reached the front door of the main pavilion, the entire staff was already assembled at the foot of the steps. Rachel attempted to count the number of people but stopped at 30. The maids stood elegantly in their black silk qipaos on the left, and the men in their black James Peirce uniforms on the right, creating two diagonal lines in V formation, like migrating geese. Colette took her place at the apex of the V as the rest of the group waited at the top of the steps. Colette turned around and made a final inspection.
"Who has the towels? The hot towels!"
One of the younger maids stepped out of the line holding a small silver chest.
"What are you doing? Get back in formation!"
Roxanne screamed as the convoy of black Audi SUVs came speeding up the driveway. The doors on the lead SUV flung open, and several men in black suits and dark sunglasses emerged, one of them approaching the middle car and opening the door. Judging by how thick the door was, Nick surmised it was a reinforced, bomb-proof model. A short, stocky man in a bespoke three-piece suit was the first to emerge. Roxanne, who was standing next to Nick, let out a barely audible gasp. Seeing that the man appeared to be no older than his mid-twenties, Nick asked,
I take it that's not Colette's father?
It's not, Roxanne said curtly, before stealing a quick glance at Carlton. Chapter 9 Michael and Astrid, Singapore. Is that all you're wearing? Michael asked, lurking by the doorway of Astrid's dressing room.
What do you mean? Am I too scantily clad for you?
Astrid joked as she struggled to fasten the delicate clasp on her sandals. You look so casual.
I'm not that casual, Astrid said, standing up.
She was wearing a short black tunic dress with crochet panels and black fringe. We're going to one of the best restaurants in Singapore, and it's with the IBM people.
Just because Andre is a top restaurant doesn't mean it's formal. I thought this was just a casual business dinner with a few of your clients.
It is, but the bigwig is flying in and he's bringing his wife, who's supposedly very chic. Astrid shot Michael a look. Had aliens secretly abducted her husband and replaced him with some finicky fashion editor? In the 6 years they had been married, Michael had never made a single comment about what she wore. He had, on certain occasions, grunted that something looked sexy or pretty on her, but he had never used a word like chic. Until today, it wasn't part of his vocabulary. Astrid dabbed a little rose essential oil onto her neck and said, If the wife is as chic as you say, she will probably appreciate this El Tuzara dress. It's a runway look that never went into production, which I'm wearing with Tabitha Simmons' silk striped sandals, lean Votra gold earrings and my Peranakan gold bracelet. Maybe it's all the gold. It looks a bit kansia to me.
The literal translation is pull vehicle, but this Hokkien term refers to rickshaw pullers or anything that is deemed low class. Of course, Michael has never been to Manhattan, where pedicab drivers tend to be out-of-work male models who charge more than Uber black cars.
Couldn't you swap it out for diamonds or something?
There's nothing kantia about this bracelet.
It's actually part of an heirloom suite that my great-aunt Mathilda Leong bequeathed to me, which is now on loan to the Asian Civilizations Museum. They are dying for me to let them display this piece too, but I held on to it for sentimental reasons.
Sorry, I didn't mean to offend your auntie, and I'm not a fashion gorilla or whatever like you.
This is one of the most important business deals I've ever been involved in. But please, wear what you want. I'll be downstairs waiting. Michael said in a patronizing tone. Astrid sighed. She knew all this fuss had something to do with that silly Hong Kong gossip columnist Barb about Michael needing to upgrade his wife's jewelry. Even though he denied it, the comments must have gotten under her skin. She made her way to the vault, punched in the 9-digit code to open the door, and peered inside. Damn, the earrings she was thinking of were at the big vault at OCBC Bank. The only thing she had of any significant size at home was a pair of gargantuan Watsky diamond and emerald pendant earrings that her grandmother had inexplicably handed her after Mahjong at Tyersal Park the other day. The emeralds on each side were almost the size of walnuts. Apparently, the last time her grandmother had worn them was at King Bhumibol of Thailand's coronation in 1950.
Well, if Michael really wants a Busby Berkeley showstopper, that's what he's going to get.
But what outfit could possibly go with these earrings?
Astrid scanned her closet and pulled out a black Yves Saint Laurent jumpsuit with a drawstring waist and jet beaded sleeves. This was just dressy and yet simple enough to complement a pair of outrageously bling earrings. She would wear them with a pair of Alaya ankle boots to give the whole look an extra edge. Astrid felt a little lump in her throat as she put the jumpsuit on. She had never worn it before because it was too precious to her. It was Eve's final couture collection in 2002, and though she was only 23 when she had a fitting for this, it still draped against her body more perfectly than almost anything else she owned.
God, I miss Eve's.
Astrid headed downstairs to the nursery, where she found Michael keeping Cassian company at the children's dining table while he ate his spaghetti with meatballs.
Wow, vous êtes top, madame,
Cassian's nanny exclaimed as Astrid entered.
Merci, Ludovine. Saint-Laurent? Qui d'autre?
Ludovine placed her hand on her chest and shook her head in awe. She could not wait to try it on as soon as Madame left the house tomorrow. Astrid turned to Michael.
Is this good enough to impress your IBM bigwig?
Where on earth did you get those earrings? Chinoke.
Real or fake, in Hokkien? Michael exclaimed.
Tin. My grandmother just gave them to me, Astrid replied, slightly annoyed that Michael only noticed the earrings and failed to appreciate the subtle genius of her jumpsuit.
Wallan!
Literally, my cock. This Hokkien swear is comparable to the American fucking hell.
Van Cleef and Arma strikes again!
Astrid winced. Michael had punished Cassian for using cuss words, and yet here he was swearing like a sailor right in front of him.
Look, doesn't Mummy look pretty tonight?
Michael said to Cassian, pinching a meatball from his bowl and popping it into his mouth.
Yes, Mummy always looks pretty, Cassian said. And stop stealing my meatballs.
Astrid melted instantly. How could she be annoyed at Michael when he looked so cute sitting in the little chair next to Cassian? Things had gotten much better between father and son since she returned from Venice. After kissing Cassian goodbye, the two of them headed outside to the front driveway, where their chauffeur, Yusef, was doing a final polish on the chrome work of Michael's 1961 red Ferrari California Spider. Jesus, he's really out to impress tonight, Astrid thought.
Thanks for changing, hun. It really means a lot to me, Michael said, as he held open the car door.
Astrid nodded as she climbed in.
If you think it makes any difference, I'm happy to help.
They drove in silence at first, enjoying the balmy breeze through the open top. But as he turned onto Holland Road, Michael picked up the conversation again.
How much do you think your earrings are worth?
Probably more than this car.
I paid $8.9 million for this Rari. You really think your earrings are worth more? We should get them valued.
Astrid found his line of questioning slightly tacky. She never thought of jewelry in terms of prices, and wondered why Michael even brought it up.
I'm never going to sell them, so what's the point?
Well, we do want to insure them, don't we?
It all goes under my family's umbrella policy. I just add it to a list that Miss Young keeps at the family office.
I didn't know about this. Can my vintage sports cars get on the policy too?
I don't think so. It's just for Leong's,
Astrid blurted out before regretting her choice of words. Michael didn't seem to notice and continued chattering away.
You're really getting all of your Ama's biggest jewels, aren't you? Your cousins must be envious as hell.
Oh, there's plenty to go around. Fiona got the Grand Duchess Olga sapphires, and my cousin Cecilia got some superb imperial jade. My grandmother is very discerning. She gives the right pieces to whomever she knows will appreciate them the most.
Do you think she feels she's going to conk off soon?
What a thing to say,
Astrid exclaimed, giving Michael a look of horror.
Come on, la. It must be going through her mind, which is why she's begun divesting all her stuff. Old people can sense when they're going to die, you know.
Michael, my grandmother has been around all my life, and I can't even begin to imagine the day when she won't be here.
Sorry, I was just making conversation.
They lapsed into silence again, Michael focusing on the client dinner and Astrid contemplating their disagreeable conversation. Michael had always shied away from anything to do with money when they first got married, especially if it involved her family, and went to great pains to show that he had absolutely no interest in her financial affairs. Indeed, their marriage had been rocked to its core by his insecurities over her fortune and his ill-conceived attempt to set her free. But thankfully, that awful period was well behind them. But ever since his business had exploded into a huge success, he had become the proverbial mouse that roared. It dawned on Astrid that at family gatherings these days, her husband always seemed to be at the center of the financial debates with the men.
Michael relished being the go-to guy for advice about the tech industry, and the newfound respect he was forging with her father and brothers, who had for years treated him with barely veiled condescension. He had also discovered his acquisitive side, and Astrid had watched in wide-eyed wonder as his taste had upgraded faster than you could say, "Do you take Amex?" She glanced over at him now, cutting such a dashing figure in his dark gray Cesare Attolini suit and his perfectly knotted Borelli tie, the face of his Patek Philippe Nautilus chronograph glinting under the flash of street lamps as he shifted gears forcefully on his iconic automobile, the one that every hot-blooded male from James Dean to Ferris Bueller had coveted. She was proud of all he had achieved, but part of her missed the old Michael, the man who was happiest lounging at home in his soccer kit, enjoying his plate of tau yu bak.
Pork belly cooked in soy sauce, a simple Hokkien dish.
With white rice and his tiger beer. As they drove along palm tree-lined Neil Road, Astrid gazed at all the colorful heritage shop houses. Then she realized they had just sped past the restaurant.
"Hey, you missed a turn. That was Bukit Paso we just passed."
"Don't worry, I did that on purpose. We're going to circle the block for a while."
"Why? Aren't we already late?"
"I've decided to give them a little more time to cool their heels. I instructed the maitre d' to make sure they get drinks at the bar first, and that they are seated right by the window so that they will have the best view of us pulling up. I want all the guys to see me get out of this car, and then I want them to see you getting out of this car."
Astrid almost wanted to laugh. Who was this man next to her talking this way?
Michael continued. "We're playing this game of chicken right now, and I know they want to see who blinks first. They have raging hard-ons to acquire this new proprietary technology that we've developed, and it's really important that I'm able to convey the right image to them."
They finally pulled up outside the elegant white colonial-era shophouse that had been converted into one of the island's most acclaimed restaurants. As Astrid got out of the car, Michael looked her over and said,
"You know, I think you made a mistake changing out of that first cocktail dress. It showed off your sexy legs. But at least you have those earrings. That's really going to make their jaws drop, especially the wife. It'll be great. I want them to know that I'm not going to be a cheap date."
Staring at him in disbelief, Astrid stumbled for a moment on the pristine wooden deck leading to the front door.
Michael grimaced. "Shit, I hope they didn't see you do that. Why the hell are you wearing those ridiculous boots anyway?"
Astrid breathed in deeply. "What's the wife's name again?"
"Wendy, and they have a dog named Gizmo. You can talk about the dog with her."
A wave of nausea churned like acid at the base of her throat. For the first time in her life, she had a true appreciation of how it felt to be treated like a cheap date. Chapter 10. The Bings, Shanghai. Nick, Rachel, Carlton, and Roxanne stood on the wide stone steps of the Bing estate, watching Colette give a warm hug to the man that had just stepped out of the convoy of SUVs.
"Who's that?" Nick asked Roxanne.
"Richie Yang," Roxanne replied, before adding in a whisper,
"one of Colette's suitors, who's based in Beijing."
"He's rather dressed up for tonight."
"Oh, he's always very fashionable. Noblesse magazine ranked him the best-dressed man in China, and his father is ranked the fourth richest man in China by the Heron Wealth Report, with a net worth of U.S. $15.3 billion.
A short, slight man in his early 50s emerged from the armored SUV. His face had a slightly punched-in look, something that his neatly trimmed Errol Flynn mustache only served to accentuate.
"Is that Colette's father?" Nick asked.
"Yes, that is Mr. Bing."
"What's he ranked?" Nick asked in jest. He found these rankings to be rather ridiculous and more often than not wildly inaccurate.
"Mr. Bing is ranked fifth richest, but the Heron is wrong. At current share prices, Mr. Bing should be ranked higher than Richie's father. Fortune Asia has it correct. It ranks Mr. Bing at number 3.
Roxanne said earnestly. What an outrage. I should write a letter to the Heron Wealth Report to protest the error, Nick joked.
Oh, no need, sir. We already have, Roxanne replied.
Mr. Bing helped a woman with shoulder-length bouffant hair, dark-tinted sunglasses, and a blue surgical mask over her face out of the car.
That's Mrs. Bing, Roxanne whispered.
I figured.
Is she ill?
No. She's just an extreme germaphobe. This is why she spends most of her time on the big island of Hawaii, where she thinks the air is freshest, and why this estate has a state-of-the-art air-purifying system.
Everyone watched as Colette gave her parents polite half-hugs, after which the maid bearing the chest of hot towels prostrated herself in front of them as if she were offering gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Colette's parents, who wore matching navy blue cashmere Hermes trek suits, took the steaming towels and began wiping their hands and faces methodically. Mrs. Bing then stretched out her hands, and another maid rushed up and squirted hand sanitizer onto her eager palms. After they had finished, Wolseley offered his greetings, and then Colette gestured for the group to approach.
Papa, Mama, meet my friends. You know Carlton, of course. This is his sister Rachel and her husband Nicholas Young. They live in New York, but Nicholas is from Singapore.
Carlton Bao, how is your father doing these days? Colette's father said as he clapped him on the back before turning to Nick and Rachel.
Jack Bing, he said, shaking their hands vigorously.
He eyed Rachel with much interest, saying in Mandarin,
You look unmistakably like your brother.
Colette's mother, by contrast, did not extend her hands, but nodded quickly as she peered at them from behind her surgical mask and Fendi sunglasses.
Richie's plane was parked next to ours when we landed, Jack Bing said to his daughter.
I just flew in from Chile, Richie explained. I insisted he join us for dinner, Colette's father said.
Of course, Colette said.
And look who's here. Carlton Bao, the man with nine lives, Richie cracked.
Rachel noticed Carlton's jaw tense up the same way hers did whenever she was annoyed, but he laughed politely at Richie's comment. Everyone made their way into the grand salon. Upon entering, they were met by a man who Rachel thought looked rather familiar. He stood by the door bearing a tray that held a sparkling decanter and a freshly poured glass of scotch. It suddenly dawned on her that she had seen him at Din Tai Fung, where he had been introduced as the sommelier. She realized now that the Frenchman didn't work for the restaurant. He was the Bing's personal master sommelier.
Would you care for the 12-year-old sherry to welcome you home, sir? He said to Mr. Bing.
Nick had to bite his tongue to keep from cracking up. The man sounded like he was offering Colette's father the services of a child prostitute.
Ah, Baptiste, thank you, Jack Bing said in heavily accented English as he grabbed the heavy-cut glass tumbler from the tray.
Mrs. Bing removed her surgical mask, headed for the nearest sofa, and plopped down with a satisfied sigh.
No, Mother, let's not sit here. Let's sit on the sofa by the windows, Colette said.
Ay-ya, I've been flying all day, and my feet are so swollen. Why can't you just let me sit here?
Mother, I have the maid specially fluff the lotus silk pillows on that sofa for you, and the magnolia trees are in full bloom this week. We must sit by the window so you can enjoy them, Colette said sharply.
Rachel jumped at Colette's tone. Mrs. Bing got up reluctantly, and the whole group made their way to the wall of glass at the end of the grand salon.
Now, Mother, sit here so you can face the topiaries. Dad, you sit here. Mei Qing will bring little stools for your feet. Mei Qing, where are the pillow top stools?
Colette demanded. Colette made herself comfortable on the chaise lounge facing in from the windows, but for everyone else sitting in that spot, the setting sun cast a blinding glare. It began to dawn on Rachel and Nick that the elaborate welcoming ritual they had witnessed outside wasn't something that Colette did out of fear or filial respect for her parents. Rather, Colette was just an absolute control freak and liked everything done precisely her way. As everyone leaned at awkward angles to avoid the glare, Jack Bing gave Nick a discerning look. Who is this man married to Bao Gao Liang's love child? He has a jaw so chiseled it could slice sushi, and he carries himself like a duke. He nodded at Nick and said, "So, you are from Singapore. Very interesting country. What line of work are you in?"
"I'm a history professor," Nick replied.
"Nick studied law at Oxford, but he teaches at New York University," Colette added.
"You went to all the trouble of getting a law degree at Oxford, but you don't practice?"
Jack asked. "Must be a failed lawyer." "I've never practiced. History was always my first passion. Next, he's going to ask me how much money I make or what my parents do." Jack said. "Only these crazy Singaporeans can waste money sending their children to Oxford for nothing. Maybe he comes from one of those rich Indonesian Chinese families."
"What does your father do?"
And there it is. Nick had met innumerable Jack Bings over the years, successful, ambitious men who were always looking to make connections with people they deemed worthy. Nick knew that by simply dropping a few of the right names, he could easily impress someone like Jack Bing. Since he had no interest in doing that, he answered politely.
"My father was an engineer, but he's retired now."
"I see," Jack said. "What a waste of a man. With his height and looks, he could have been a top banker or a politician. Now he's either going to dig further about my family or move on to Rachel's inquisition."
Nick asked out of courtesy, "And what do you do, Mr. Bing?"
Jack ignored Nick's question and turned his attention to Richie Yang.
"So, Richie, tell me what you were doing in Chile of all places. Scouting for more mining companies that your father can acquire?"
"Oh, very nice. I've been deemed inconsequential, and he obviously couldn't give a damn what Rachel does." Nick chuckled to himself. Richie, who was staring intently at his titanium Virtu phone, scoffed at Jack's words.
"Good God, no! I'm training for the Dakar Rally. You know, that off-road vehicle endurance race. It's held in South America now. The course starts in Argentina and ends in Peru."
"You're still racing?" Carlton piped in.
"Of course."
"Unbelievable." Carlton shook his head, his voice laced with anger.
"What, you think I go running home to mommy after just one little wreck?"
Carlton went red in the face, and he looked like he was about to leap out of his chair and lunge at Richie. Colette placed her hand on his arm and said in a cheery voice,
"I've always wanted to visit Machu Picchu, but you know I get terrible altitude sickness. I went to St. Moritz last year and got so ill I could hardly do any shopping."
"You never told me that.
See how you constantly put your life in danger by going to dangerous places like Switzerland?"
Mrs. Bing admonished her daughter. Colette turned to her mother and said in an irritated tone,
"It was fine, Mother. Now who died and made you Jackie Onassis? Why are you wearing those sunglasses in the house?"
Mrs. Bing sighed dramatically.
"Hi-ya, you don't know my latest suffering."
She took off her sunglasses and revealed puffy, swollen eyes.
"I can't open my eyes properly anymore. See? See?
I think I have this very rare disease called mayonnaise gravis."
"Oh, you mean myasthenia gravis," Rachel offered.
"Yes, yes, you know it," Mrs. Bing said excitedly. "It affects the muscles around your eyes."
Rachel nodded sympathetically. "I've heard it can be very debilitating, Mrs. Bing."
"Please, call me Lighty,"
Colette's mother said, warming up to Rachel.
You do not have mayonnaise gravy or whatever you call it, Mother. Your eyes are all swollen because